Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to The Writer's Block with Jim Christina and Bobby Bell, right here on LA Talk Radio.
It is 8 o'clock. This is LA Talk Radio, and you are listening to The Writer's Block. I am Jim Christina in studio tonight with Bobby Jean Bell, her husband Jim, who no longer holds up our wall.
He's in a chair.
Hey, I have to ask, number one, did you get our birthday greeting last week?
We did.
Oh, perfect. Okay.
Yes.
And how did the concert series go?
It was wonderful. Dave Stamey, one of the most loved Western musicians working today, gave us an amazing night. Full house. Wonderful. Yes. Wonderful birthday cake and just a really magical night. And we thank everybody for coming out and showing also Dave a great warm welcome in Old Town New Hall.
Cool.
Yeah.
If I sound tonight like I'm gravelly, it's because I'm suffering from allergies. So
you always sound kind of gravelly.
I know, but if I have to break away and give you the mic for a second, it's because I'm going to go blow my nose. Hey, in studio tonight, we have a really cool lady sitting here.
Can you believe this, actually, Jim?
That she's actually sitting in here is what blows me. And you know, she's a kick-ass lady. She's just done so much.
I know.
I mean... She actually was a bodyguard for a hooker.
Among other things.
Who does that?
Party crasher.
Party crasher. chip chatter. I mean, she's just done it all. And the lady has a doctorate, two PhDs, BAs or BSs?
I have two BAs, two masters, and a PhD.
And a PhD.
I have a BA.
Yeah. Well, and that's all I have, too.
I have one lousy degree. Got me. No.
I know. Well, I remember the day we were contacted by her office.
Yes.
And you and I right away were like, oh, my gosh. And we went online. And I was like, Jim, can you believe that Dr. Charlotte Laws?
I know, huh?
So.
And are we supposed to be calling you Dr. Laws?
Oh, I was going to ask.
Call me Charlotte.
Okay. Don't call you late for dinner. You were a Los Angeles City Commissioner for a time being.
I was, actually.
And you were appointed by?
Mayor Villaraigosa.
Yeah, okay. I was wondering if that was who did it.
Yes, that was the culprit.
I mean, you've lived in Vegas, Georgia, here in L.A.
And Florida.
And Florida.
Uh-huh.
God, you get around.
I do.
And I actually have a copy here of your book that just was released in February.
Yes.
It is Rebel in High Heels. It's the story of the fearless mom who battled and defeated the kingpin of revenge porn and the dangerous forces of conformity. And why don't you tell us a little bit about this? Because it's a very interesting subject. Yeah. I was never even aware there was revenge porn.
I wasn't either. Yeah. I wasn't either.
I knew there was stuff like it, but I didn't know that's what it was called. And so,
yeah. It's non-consensual pornography or the distribution of nude or topless pictures of individuals without their consent. And what happened was in October 2013, my daughter took some pictures with her cell phone in the mirror in her bedroom, and one of those pictures was topless. And she sent all these pictures to her computer by way of her email, never intending to show the topless picture to anyone. And 3 months later, she was hacked. And then 9 days after that, the topless picture ended up on the most notorious revenge porn website called isanyoneup.com. And she was devastated and freaked out and didn't know what to do and phoned me. And that's the first time I had ever heard of it. And then I just, you know, tried to get the picture down, which was extremely difficult because the website owner refused to remove content. He had been paying a hacker, as I learned. As time went by, I learned there was a hacking scheme. I started reaching out to other victims. I contacted the FBI. The FBI opened an investigation, and for about a year they investigated. And about a year ago or more, Hunter Moore was arrested, and his hacker was arrested. They both pled guilty, and the sentencing for Hunter Moore is in about 3 weeks, and the hacker sentencing is in November. So, and now we have laws in about 25 states against revenge porn, and we have a federal law that will be introduced in a few weeks.
Wow.
Yeah.
And it got its term revenge porn because initially the concept was that you had a spat with, you know, your partner, and you had this kind of photos, and out of spite, you know, you posted. But that's not what this is about at all. And there was real maliciousness in the posting.
Guess, this is more about hacking, wasn't it?
Because they
About hacking, identity theft.
And then
theft.
They would share, identity theft, because then they figured out how to share that image with all the person's
identifying information. Their name, city, social media.
So
link.
Friends and who they worked with. And so it wasn't just on a site that some people maybe went to see. It became really public.
Yeah, the follower, Hunter Moore's followers, were really avid about trying to ruin people's lives. I mean, that was kind of the goal of the website. So if you're a teacher, the school board would get the picture, the other teachers, the parents, it would be sent out saying, fire that slut, and you have a whore teaching your children, and, you know, that kind of thing. So it was, the goal was to get the person to commit suicide, to, really get them fired and just ruin their
get that.
Yeah, that was their hobby. And Hunter Moore had this cult that was called The Family. They used kind of Charles Manson type of language. You know, he's the father. They're the children. Some of the children would say, we will kill for you, father. I mean, it was a very scary cult.
Well, you had threats too, didn't you?
And I got death threats. I got computer viruses. I had a stalker at my house. I mean, it was a huge nightmare fighting against Hunter Moore's followers. It was scary because you don't know who these people are. They're anonymous and you don't know if they're dangerous or not. So it was quite an ordeal, and it lasted about 3 years.
Wow.
3 years of my life, and it was really a full-time job dealing with this.
And I assume you'll be going to the sentencing hearings.
Absolutely. I've been to every hearing. And
does he cringe whenever he sees your face now? Does
he actually acts kind of like cocky and looks at me with a smirk like, ha, 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 I won. That's how he acted last time.
They have ways of fixing that in prison. Using just those words.
Well, this is a gal you want on your side.
Yeah, absolutely. I wouldn't go against her illegally or in a dark alley.
Well, and you learned some interesting things, too, about copyrights. You began to learn, how to try to give the victims some suggestions on things to do. Mm-hmm. And there was very interesting that websites aren't really held responsible for what they post.
Right, because of Section 230 of the Communications Decency Act, which holds the website owner harmless. And so the owner is seen as a platform, and he's a platform provider rather than a content provider. And so that's why revenge porn hasn't been illegal. It is now. As I said, states are passing laws against it, various countries. Israel has a law against it. UK, there's lots of laws coming into place. But, when all this started, it was a new topic and no one knew anything about it. And that's why I started reaching out to all these victims. And a lot of times, 50% of the time, I would say, I was the first one to tell them they were on the site. So I felt like a suicide hotline. I mean, they were in tears. I was the only person they could confide in. And I was trying to do what I could to help because no one really knew anything about this subject. And I spoke to 9 attorneys at the very beginning, and they were all kind of throwing up their arms saying, I don't know. I don't know what you do. So I had to kind of learn myself. I had to become that expert in order to help my daughter and to help the other victims who were really all over the world, but primarily in the United States with respect to this particular website. So it was really a full-time job, and I became called, they call me the Erin Brockovich of revenge porn. And I've talked to over 300 victims to date, and I got an email today. I had one yesterday. I still get contacted regularly from people because of either some kind of cyber harassment or revenge porn or something related to internet crime.
Wow.
And I do what I can to help those individuals. Yeah.
Hey, let me give you a number out. If you want to call and talk to Charlotte, she's sitting right next to me. That's number here is 818-602-4929. That's 818-602-4929. And you can call. And you can talk directly to Charlotte. You can ask her anything you want. Just be nice about it.
The book, right away, pretty quickly into the book, you talk about that there are going to be 3 themes in the book. And that there are perseverance is the key to success. Mm-hmm. And I certainly felt that throughout the book. You really demonstrate that so beautifully. What would you say are the other two keys to success?
I talk about the key to happiness being helping others and other centrism. But I do think perseverance is definitely number one. I think thinking outside of the box, yeah, showing up in life, you know, living in the bold zone, which a lot of people just don't show up.
The bold zone? I love that. What is that?
Basically just showing up, going after your dreams, you know, persisting, being there, you know, saying, hey, I can do it, and having that confidence and going for it. I mean, confidence is very important. If you don't have it, fake it until you get it. You know?
Well, and her book is certainly written by a very confident gal. All of the things.
There's no doubt.
But, you know, it's funny because when I was, you know, because it goes into my childhood, I didn't feel confident. And it is interesting when I read it now, I think this sounds like a confident person. But inside of me, boy, I was not confident, I can tell you right now. So it is kind of interesting. It doesn't even seem to go together with how I felt. It's such a difference, you know.
But you took all the steps. I mean, you had a goal. You knew what you wanted, mm-hmm, and you pushed past the fear. And I think that's, you know, you call it also the lazy zone, the bold zone that's just beyond the fear zone and
right,
the lazy zone. And
right,
I think I didn't ever thought about a lazy zone. I guess I think a procrastinator, I can be a procrastinator, but actually lazy zone is a better way to, you know, if you're sitting on the couch a lot watching reality shows and you're not out there making reality, you know, you're
right
in the lazy zone.
Right.
Yeah, that's
right,
pretty true.
Right. Well, I hope it inspires people. I mean, that's what my book is supposed to do, is make you go after your dreams and think, I can do it. And I hope that happens. I really like the idea of helping people, you know, pursue whatever it is they want.
Well, you know, if I hadn't written a first paragraph in The Hunter, I would never have written a book, and none of them ever would have written 11 of them. And if we hadn't pursued this, we wouldn't be here.
Right.
Right. Well, you have to start. That's, you know,
someone else would have the 8 o'clock time slot.
You just have to. You just have to start.
Yeah.
How long did it take you to write this book?
Well, I started the book. It was a long process because I started the book way before the revenge porn stuff began. So
right,
I started it a couple of years before. So I would say that it was 3 years or something, but it was 800 pages when I got it finished. And the revenge porn stuff was supposed to be a chapter in this book, even though the book was way too long and I knew I was going to have to divide it into two books or do something. Obviously, I can't publish it 800 pages. But what happened when I wrote that, while I was writing that chapter and I was in the middle of it, it was long. It was a pretty long chapter. It was 6,000 words or something. You know, it's a pretty long chapter. XO Jane, the publication online, contacted my daughter asking her, would you like to write an article about the revenge porn situation? But my daughter doesn't write, so she forwarded the email to me. And I talked to them, and they said, we want an article, maybe 800 words, that people won't read it if it's more than 800 or 1,000 words. And I said, well, I have this chapter, but I don't know, you know, first of all, it's 6,000 words that I'm working on. And so I kind of put them off for a few weeks. And then I thought, all right, I'll let you publish it if you want to. And so they did publish it, and it went viral. And so I realized the importance of publishing things. If you want to do a book, you should be putting those articles out there, because that's going to help you get your agent. That's going to help you get your publishing house. That's going to help with everything. And it went viral with 1,800,000 hits, crazy. Agents called me. Publishing houses called me. Movie people called me. A-list actress called me. Everybody started calling me saying, you know, we want to do something with this. And I got all this attention, which as a writer, I used to have to, like with my first book, I had to, literally, I was crashing publishing houses for my first book and getting into Simon & Schuster. And, you know, I had to go to a lot of trouble to try to get that first book published. This time, everybody was coming to
me, you.
All because of this article. And I thought, wow, there's a lot of value in, you know, something like that. And so I think that's one of the keys, is you kind of throw things against the wall till something sticks. But so that ended up being a really important thing. And then the publishing houses all wanted a book only about revenge porn initially. And so I thought, well, that's not a book I would read, because I like lots of stuff to happen. I don't like books that could be, you know, a chapter and then you just draw it out into a book. But I said, that's fine, I would be willing to do that. But that didn't end up happening, so it ended up being this kind of combination of the first 22 years of my life with the revenge porn, which is something I prefer.
And it's a brilliant combination, because it starts out with a very hot topic and very timely.
Right. Mm-hmm.
And then the way that you weave and we go back and forth is terrific.
Really, we have to break for a commercial.
Oh, okay.
We have a new sponsor, Target Freight Management, and this is their very first ad ever, and it's gone out nationally. So enjoy.
Hey, Jim Christina here for all you LTL shippers. This density-based pricing structure is unfortunately here to stay. So are you tired of your freight being reclassed? Tired of calling several freight companies for the best rate for your shipments? Then, of course, they reclass you anyway, and there goes the race. Then Target Freight Management has just the solution for you. Their customized transportation management system protects all of their clients from situations just like yours. If you're currently shipping a density-based product, you need to call Target Freight today. Target Freight is currently saving their clients between 15 and 20% of their freight costs, and that's a huge savings to anyone. They will even do a free cost analysis of your current freight programs to see if you are a good fit for their program, and not everyone is. The kicker is, Target Freight is only paid strictly on the contingency they can save you money on your LTL costs. Call Target Freight Management today and just see what they can do for your company. Target Freight Management, 888-653-1323. Call Target Freight Management at 888-653-1323. I did.
And if you're an internet guy like I am, you can always go at www.targetfmi.com. And again, 818-602-4929 is the numbers here to call in studio. And we're also brought to you by Black Dog Publishing and by Out West Boutique and Cultural Center. And we're back with Charlotte Laws. I have a question, and it's probably kind of like a... Well, there's no dumb question, so I'm just going to ask it. You've written for, like, the Huffington Post, for all these articles and publications and newspapers. How the hell did you get into that?
I just wanted to, I like to have my opinion heard. If I'm going to write something, I want people to read it. And so I started submitting. I submit to various newspapers and magazines, and frankly, it takes a lot of persistence to get articles published. At least that's my experience. For example, the New York Times has still not published me. It has been 12 years that I have been sending them articles, and they have not yet published me. I think it's like one of the few that has not published me, and I'm really pissed off about it, frankly.
Perseverance. So,
that's because they know you're a closet Trump fight.
And now what I'm doing is I actually, within the last month, I've started targeting specific individuals within the New York Times, because just submitting it to them is not, mm-hmm. I'm not getting them a response at all. So, but yeah, it takes a lot of persistence, and if you can build up a relationship also with the editors, it helps. But sometimes you'll send, 20 articles and you'll never hear anything, and then all of a sudden, miraculously, somebody will respond. But I may send an article 20 or 30 places before it finally gets published. It can take a lot of time.
That's the P word, patience.
Patience, yeah. And perseverance.
Perseverance.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, that's that key.
Definitely.
And I know that you you really like to say that you empathize with the underdog.
Yes.
And with the outsider.
Yes.
And can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, I kind of always have. I don't know if it's because of my upbringing, being an adopted kid and feeling like an outsider in my community. I had a very negative family life and did not fit into Atlanta, which when I grew up, it was the snobby elite part of Atlanta, the old money people. And there was a lot of racism and a lot of, snobbiness, essentially, and preppiness and that kind of thing. So I don't know. I immediately always did. And I fought for civil rights, which was something that was not popular. So I was attacked for that pretty much every day at school by at least some people at my school, and came to realize that, that was kind of my mission, to help victims. And mm-hmm. so animal rights has become a passion of mine, and helping revenge porn victims and helping with gay rights. I recently wrote something called the Intolerant Jackass Act, which I don't know if you saw, but it was to counter an attorney in Orange County had written an initiative for California called the Sodomite Suppression Act, which called for the killing of all gays in the state of California. And so in response, I wrote my own initiative and submitted it to Kamala Harris's office. And it basically said, for anyone who calls for the killing of all gays in an initiative, they have to go to sensitivity training and donate $5,000 to a pro-gay or pro-lesbian organization. So that was a biggie.
I love it.
That was recent, within the last few months. So that was... Anyway.
Well, and I think you you commented in the book, too, fairly early on, that you kind of see your life's mission is to eradicate prejudice.
Yes, definitely. I definitely.
What a wonderful mission. What a big mission. Got to rally a lot of folks around you to do that.
Right.
What is... Because I wasn't familiar with this. What is speciesism?
Speciesism is prejudice against animals. It's the idea that, you know, a lot of people feel that humans are superior to other animals, you know, and I don't agree with that, of course. And it's really, speciesism is no different from racism or sexism or anti-Semitism. It's just this arrogant attitude that humans have that they're superior. Mm-hmm. And
Our society tends to like to tack isms on the back of things.
We're definitely into isms.
Yeah, we're an ism society. Society-ism.
So that's why I talk about omniocracy, which is a government with representation for all living beings, trying to broaden that out, not to be just humans. Yeah.
There was a little segment in your book that I found – I actually laughed out loud because it was so true for the South at that time. You were voted the best dressed in your high school, in a high school that wore uniforms.
Well, I love that she loved belts.
Yes, yes.
Yeah,
and that
belts.
Silver sequin dress.
Yeah.
That you bought when you were, 17 years old?
Yes, exactly. Yeah, I had a lot of really outrageous clothes. I liked,
I liked flashy
clothing, but that was not acceptable in old money Atlanta, so I was the unacceptable person.
Missy didn't wear that kind of clothing, did she?
She wasn't supposed to, because Missy was a debutante, and Missy was not supposed to dress like that. Missy was the name I went by as a child, for anybody who didn't know that.
Yeah. And you had a brother.
I had a brother, yes.
And he passed away.
Yes, he was killed in a car accident when he was 16. And then my mom, who was my adoptive mom, but she committed suicide when I was 16 and my brother was 14, and he was the one who found her. She didn't die right away. She had she was semi-conscious, so she had brain damage, and she was in a convalescent home for about 10 years until her official death. But she was never the same. She didn't have control of about half of her body. She didn't have her memory for the most part. And my father forbade us to ever visit her or mention her name in the house again. And this was literally, he told us, the day after she had cut her wrists, her neck, and taken pills and been taken off first to the hospital and then to the convalescent home. And he never visited her, and he got a divorce. And so I had to sneak my brother to visit my mom because he couldn't drive. He was 14. So we had to sneak behind my dad's back. But my mom used to say I was very sneaky, so lucky for her, I was. She was right about that.
Well, for your brother, though, it kind of seemed like that was the day the music died for him.
That's really true. I mean, he never recovered from that, and he was, you know, a very sensitive kid. Mm. And my dad was... I mean, it's funny because I saw when I was writing this book that my dad was definitely the antagonist of the story, but I've softened since I wrote the book. I see him in a more balanced way. And so I can see his positive, and, you know, and he was not good at family. He was not a sensitive person. He was never home. He was a workaholic, but he was also very successful and he was very goal-oriented. But he was verbally abusive, too. Mm-hmm. And when my brother died, he said to me, he was always the good one. You were the bad one. You're the one who should have died, not him. Something that I have never forgotten, which is not a very nice thing to say to your child. So, you know, he does have those negative things about him. Mm-hmm. But I have kind of we at least have a relationship now, which we didn't for about 20-something years. And it was not because of me. He actually refused to be in touch with me when I got pregnant with my daughter. I wasn't married at the time. He said, "You're out of my life. You're not married. You had a kid out of wedlock. That's it. See ya." And he didn't even meet his only grandchild, my daughter, until recently, within the last few years. And so, and she's 28 now. So he met her when she was maybe 24, 25 for the first time. And he's only seen her a couple of times. So, but I do talk to him on the phone now. He does take my calls, which he didn't used to do. And I've, you know, he's in his late 80s and I've softened towards him and I can see, you know, mm-hmm. more positive. Ooh. So writing the book was actually really a good experience for a lot of reasons, because it made me see him differently. It made me draw connections in my own life between things that I didn't realize were connected. You know, like the idea of being a party crasher, being a philosopher, and being a private detective are the same thing.
Same thing.
I never realized it was the same thing.
Your skill set. Did you want to, what she's done?
No, go ahead. Go ahead.
Some of these things that you've done, it's really fun. This is just right off of Charlotte's website, and it's a really great website and gets so much information. But a bandit cab driver. She's got 21 and more, 21 that she lists and more. Everything from executive director, president of a legal services corporation, to backup singer for an Elvis imitator. We want to know more about that. Lecturer for the FBI Academy.
Yeah.
Tell us about that. Yeah.
Yeah.
Was that because you were crashing events and they wanted you?
It was actually on animal rights. Ah. And they were very interested. There's something called the Animal Enterprise Terrorism Act, which is a really stupid federal law, which essentially says that if you do anything against an animal enterprise, which is could be anything, could be a, you know, whatever it may be, a butcher shop, could be a, you know, an art, you know, like a science fair where they're using animals. You do anything, graffiti, blocking the sidewalk to a McDonald's, that can be considered domestic terrorism. And so they wanted to train all these police officers around the country about what is animal rights. I went in there to talk about animal rights philosophy and to lecture these police chiefs from all over the country and all over the world. And my feeling was I want to educate them. I want to let them know the other side. And my goal was to see if I could get them to, you know, raise their hand and say, yes, I would break the law to help an animal, which some of them said that, did that during my lecture, and I was really happy about that. So it was an interesting experience doing that.
Can you imagine going and sitting in a class with Charlotte teaching it and you not listening?
I would like to go sit in the class that Charlotte's teaching.
When are you
teaching again? Yeah.
Wake up.
Okay, what is chip chatter?
Oh. I love this.
Chip chatting was something when I was in Vegas, this was when I was there visiting, and I was 17 years old. I was staying at Caesar's Palace. This is how I got into it. And I was just bopping through Caesar's Palace casino area, and I had been jogging down the strip. So I had on shorts, pigtails, you know, I totally looked like a kid, right? Some guy in his 60s came up to me and said, I just won $13,000 gambling. I'd like to buy you a diamond bracelet, no strings attached. And I'm going, what? You know, come on. So he takes me over to the gift shop at Caesars. He buys me an $800 diamond bracelet. Then he says, you know, let's go gambling. So I'm walking. I'm just tagging along. I'm not gambling, but I'm tagging along behind him. And every time he wins chips, he's like stuffing them in my waist pouch. Then he says, I want to buy you some clothes. Where can I do that? And Caesars, actually, the head security guy was escorting this guy around. So he goes, oh, there's a clothing store in the hotel. So we go over and he buys me $4,000 worth of clothing. And then he says, well, that was fun. Thanks a lot. Enjoyed it. And I said, thank you so much. And then I just said bye. And I went back to my room and I had $7,700 worth of stuff, you know, clothing
and chips.
And chips, right, which were turned into money. And so, and then a few days later, I'm going through the casino again late at night. And some guy says, do you want to do the slots with me? And I said, yeah, sure, why not, you know? So I did like one row of slots with his coins, and he did another. And after about an hour, I said, well, I'm going to go. I'm really tired. And he said, well, thanks a lot. And he gave me a $100 bill. And I thought, oh my gosh, people just give you money in Vegas. This is really weird. So I ended up moving to Vegas when I was 20. And basically all I did is chat for chips. I never left the casino. I was either in the restaurant, the casino, or the showroom. It was very safe because there are so many security guards in those casinos. So a scream, you'd have 10 security guards in 1 second. I never, you know, went to anybody's room or anything that was dodgy. Mm-hmm. I never asked for chips, but they would give you chips because they'd want to gamble. gamble, and you'd sit next to them. But instead of losing them all to the casino, I'd keep as many as I possibly could. And I could make thousands of dollars in an hour, or I could make $20. Or sometimes the guy wouldn't want to gamble at all, so I'd make zero. You know, it just depended. But I made, in today's money, I made about $300,000 a year as a chip chatter, working 10 hours a week. That's all I had to do is a couple nights a week.
We got
to
move.
And so, then you got busted.
Oh, yeah. Well, I sort of. But see, it wasn't illegal, so I couldn't really get, you know. But yeah, I was doing it at the Hilton, and no one could ever tell that I was doing it. I was really good at, like, you know, I'd have my own chips, but I'd put some of my own chips in my purse without anybody noticing, you know. So, yeah, I was at the Hilton, and I was gambling this guy, and I had my purse on my left shoulder. He was sitting on my right, but I had the wrong purse, and I hadn't intended to chip chat that night. So every time I was dropping chips in my purse, it was like this clang, and I kept thinking, I can't believe he hasn't heard this, you know. And I just had them piling up, and you could see them. I mean, because they have, like, eyes in the sky, you know, in the ceilings there, and then you have the pit bosses and everyone. And I could tell that they knew, and I could tell they were going to say something to the guy I was with. And so I excused myself to go to the restroom, and when I came back, the dealer said he doesn't want to gamble with you anymore because they had told him. And I went, okay, and I left, and I came back later and cashed in the chips, and it was a lot of money.
Oh, I had never heard of such a thing.
Well, I made it up. That's why you never heard of it. It was my invention.
It was your invention.
Yes.
You must have a question.
I do. And we discussed this a little bit before we came in the studio, but party crashing, that's got to be like the ultimate and whatever.
Yeah, it's. I actually wrote my first book in 1988 was written called Meet the Stars,
right,
which tells you how to date your favorite celebrity, how to get into the Academy Awards. It gives you all those tips. And so my current book, Rebel in High Heels, has a lot of the stories in it. And I have most of the party crashing I did was when I was younger, between maybe 17 and 25 years of age. But I have still continued to do it because it's a great way to meet the president, meet senators, meet a celebrity that you want to get a script to, you know, meet whoever it might be, you know, get a job, maybe a real estate client or whatever it is that you're looking to do. It really helps when you can meet VIPs. Mm. And so I definitely am an expert in this. And they came out with an official list a few months ago. And I was so honored because I'm number 4. The 15 most notorious party crashers in the world. Bill Murray is number 6. Queen Elizabeth is number 14.
Oh, my gosh.
Lady Gaga and Serena Williams didn't make the list, but they got honorable mentions. So I was very honored to be number 4. But I can tell you that celebrities party crash way more than regular people. They do it all the time. And I've seen celebrities not even get into events. I mean, they try to get in, and then they're super embarrassed because they can't get in. So it's, yeah, and it's, so it's been great. It was a hobby initially, and it's a tool. You know?
Right, right.
Yeah.
Okay. Gypsy, a cab driver. No, it wasn't gypsy. What's the other
bandit.
One?
A bandit cab
driver.
Yes, bandit cab driver.
Well, what happened was I was at the Hilton in Las Vegas. This is also when I lived in Vegas. And I noticed that after the shows, there were these long lines of people waiting for cabs. And so I realized that I could make extra money by just nabbing people at the end of the lines and taking them to their hotels. And so I would charge $10 per person. I say, who wants, you know, I'll take you to any hotel on the strip, 10 bucks a person. I pile usually 3 people into my car, drop them off, go back for another load. And I didn't know it was illegal to do this back then because, you know, I was 20 years old. I had no idea. It was only recently that I realized this was not cool to be doing. But that was an extra way to make money when I lived in Vegas. So.
That's just an interesting life. It's just like, wow.
Now, when you were 9, you were somewhat captivated by Tom Jones.
I was.
Can you tell us a little bit about that? This time with Tom Jones?
Yeah,
Can we hold off until I get one more ad to run, and then we can take it?
Sure. So don't go away. Come back for Tom Jones.
We'll be back in 30 seconds.
Hi, Jim Christina here for TFM Truckload. TFM Truckload, a vision of Target Freight Management, is here to help you with all of your truckload and railroad shipping needs. If you want a reputable company who is willing to go to work to find you the best rate while maintaining the best service, then TFM Truckload is who you need to call. When TFM Truckload books a truck for your company, it shows up 100% of the time. So if you want a reliable truckload broker, then call TFM Truckload today. Toll free at 1-844-653-7789. That's 1-844-653-7789. TFM Truckload. I called them.
And if you're an internet guy like I am, you can go to www.targetfmi.com. That's www.targetfmi.com. And this actual show is being heard around the world, so if anywhere you want to go, give them a call. Number here to talk to Charlotte Laws is 818-602-4929. 818-602-4929. Now we can get back to Tom Jones.
So, yes, I had this childhood crush on Tom Jones when I was 9 years old. It began, and I was kidded about it. I mean, I was made fun of. People at school knew, my brother, his friends. So I was, you know, it was embarrassing. But I did, my interest did not waver. And I read articles about him and saw him interviewed on television. And I read an article where he said that Jerry Lee Lewis, the country singer, was his favorite performer. And so when I was 16, I went to a Jerry Lee Lewis concert. And I actually crashed the concert because it was sold out. And so when I got to the door, instead of turning around and going home, I said, I'm here to apply for a job. And the guy said, oh, okay, go in on the left and to the office. And so I went in, I went right. I went and sat down in the audience on the front row, and I watched the show. And it was a great show. And I was starting to leave, and this man came up to me and said, would you like to go backstage and meet Jerry Lee Lewis? And I said, yeah, sure, why not, whatever. So he took me backstage, and I met Jerry Lee Lewis. And and Jerry Lee said he had to change his clothes. And he said, you can either wait in here in this little dressing room, or you can go outside and wait. And I said, I'll go outside, thank you. And so I went back out and sat in that empty auditorium. And then the man, the white-haired man who had come up to me initially to take me backstage, came and sat down next to me. And he said, Mr. Lewis would like to be in your company this evening. And I said, well, I don't want to go out with him, but thanks anyway. And he said, you don't? All the girls want to go out with him. And he said, well, who would you want to go out with? And then he started going down the list of, you know, John Travolta and Sylvester Stallone and all the hot stars of the day. And I was going, no, no. And he said, well, isn't there anybody? And I said, well, there is one guy. And he said, who? And I said, Tom Jones. And he said, well, you could do it. You know, you're pretty and you seem very sweet and intelligent. And Jerry Lee wanted to go out with you, didn't he? And I thought, gosh, maybe I could do it. And it like built this confidence. And I was so excited. And I said, I'm going to do it. Thank you. And then I get up and I start running out of the auditorium. And he goes, wait, don't you want to go back and see Jerry Lee? And I said, no, I'm going to get a date with Tom. So I ran out of the theater. And then a year later, I went to Vegas and I was 17, when Tom was performing at Caesars. And I spent an entire week trying to get a date with him. And I did all these outrageous things, from sneaking behind all the, you know, passageways behind the showroom to try to get to the dressing room, which did not succeed, by the way. I had made this, had this showgirl costume yes. made with feathers and sequins and everything, and silver boots. And I had bribed the bellhop to tell me what room Tom was staying in, what time he went to the dressing room, and what path he took to get there. And so he told me, he gave me the right information too, because I staked out that hallway one night and I casually walked past Tom as he was heading to his dressing room. And he stopped to talk to me and flirted with me, and I could tell he was interested. His security guard didn't even know he'd stopped, and she got all the way to the end of the hall, and then she had to run back, you know, because he was talking to me. So I could tell he was interested. I sat ringside at the show every night. He paid tons of attention to me, to the point where women around me were saying, do you know him? Why does he keep looking at you? Which was great. But he did not ask me out. And I was in tears at the end of that week. And I went back to Atlanta with no date. But I believe in persistence, so I didn't give up. So about a year, year and a half later, when I was 18, he was performing in Fort Lauderdale. And I then did all the same stuff all over again. I called the theater, Sunrise Musical Theater, where he was performing, and I pretended to be my own secretary, and I said, Missy Laws, the winner of the Miss Georgia Beauty Pageant, will be in town. She needs ringside seats at the show and an introduction to Mr. Jones backstage. I got a room next to his at the same hotel. And but I didn't need to do any of these things because he saw me sitting ringside. He sent someone out to get me. I went backstage. We went to dinner in a disco, and we went out that night. He was you know, my first boyfriend, Tom was. It was really a big deal to me. He was totally just as I always thought he was. I was totally in love with him, and we dated for 3 years, and it was amazing. And since then, I have realized I make very fast decisions about men. So it's not unusual that I would have been interested in him at age 9 and not changed my mind, because my husband today, who I've been with for 21 years now, I saw a video of him at a dating organization. I was ecstatic. And by the third date, I wanted to marry him, but it took him 5.5 years to finally agree. So that's my track record. I just make these snap decisions about guys.
Oh, I love this story.
When you were writing Rebel, we have a question we ask around here, because the name of our show is The Writer's Block.
Right.
Do you ever suffer from the writer's block?
I do, I suppose. Yeah, I think if probably everybody does. I think if you're suffering from that, it's you just want to put stuff down and just try to push through it, I suppose. But I'm not a very fast writer, so I can spend an entire day and write 800 words. I mean, I don't necessarily, you know, have a very high output on, you know, material. So, but I'm kind of perfectionistic where I keep changing it and I want it to be perfect before I go on to the next thing. So I think that if you have that block, I think the best thing to do is just to kind of throw out as many different ideas and realize that maybe that day it won't come, but the next day you'll be able to kind of consolidate some of those ideas and have it work out.
Yeah, we've had such a myriad of answers on this.
Such a great question.
The authors that we've asked on this, we've gotten answers everywhere from she changed a character's name to go back and rewrite the chapter to move on.
Or I don't get them.
Or I don't get them. Yeah, we had them. I don't get them.
Yeah. Well, I mean, mine is nonfiction, so you can't obviously change the character's name. But
right.
Yeah. But yeah, that's, I mean, yeah, I would definitely, I wouldn't just plunge on, because I actually like to feel good about what I've done before I move on to the next thing. And I also tend to reread over and over.
You know, that's death too.
I know it, but it's crazy because it takes so much time,
right.
And that's why it takes me all day to write 800 words, because I keep rereading the first few paragraphs.
And a lot of what you write about, you must have to do quite a bit of research.
Yeah, I actually did tons of research because I was lucky. Like, for example, with the Tom Jones story, I mean, it was very funny because the first few dates with him, I took notes after.
I was going to ask
which
that.
Which was great. But then I stopped doing it, and I didn't have a whole bunch of notes. But one thing I did have is on our first date, which was it's pretty good that I did this. After our first date, I went back 2 weeks later, back in 1979, to the hotel, to the exact suite, and I took pictures of the suite. The bedroom, the living room, the entire thing. And then I went to the disco where we went that night. And I took pictures of like where we sat and everything. So I had those pictures. Mm-hmm. I have those pictures. So when I'm describing, you know, the suite and what it looks like and, you know, the orange and all the weird colors, which I now see that's what it is, I have those photos to go by. And then also with my celebrity experiences, of which there are many in the book, most of them I had not written up at the exact time they happened. But before my other book came out, the one in 1988, which was my very first book, I did write up every single celebrity experience, and I wrote them out longhand. And so I could go back for this book and look at that. And then with later celebrity experiences, I started writing them up the night, when I got
you
home
did.
From
mm-hmm.
the evening, like the Bill Cosby stuff. When I wrote about Bill Cosby, I had written all that stuff up thinking I was going to do an article or something about it, and I never did anything with it, but I had those notes with all that detail, and I knew exactly what Bill had said and what I had said, and I had all the dialogue, and everything was correct because I had done
it
the
right
same
then.
Night.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I did lots of research, and I'm one of these people who never throws anything away, luckily, too. So I have like little, you know, mementos from when I was with Tom and backstage passes, and I have all these little things so you could put things together, you know, like when I would go to the Grammys, even though I would crash, a lot of times I'd finagle a ticket in addition to have crashed, you know, just so I had mm-hmm. it. And so I have copies of all those things, or I have the originals.
Do you find while you were writing this book in particular, because it's such a personal story for you, do you find that when you are thinking about it, you're remembering the experience and you put it down on paper, and you start looking at that, and it brings up memories or emotions you didn't know you had? Okay, a good example is your father. You had to go through a lot of stuff with your father, and you had to write about it.
Right. Yeah, I mean, you definitely, sometimes when you write it, you look back and you realize that it was, you know, that you were thinking about it differently than when it's on paper. I suppose that's true. And as I said, you see connections, you know, or you see a different angle that you would never notice before. So it's really, I think it's great for someone to write down their life experiences, even if they don't want to make it into a book, just to do it for the exercise and for self-development purposes.
Well, and you may be able to see how the consequences or you know, it's a horrible thing that happened to your daughter, and yet the amazing results.
Right. Because I mean, a lot of positive things have come out of it.
And the lives that have been, that were so horrendously affected, but who have been able to put things back together in their lives. Mm-hmm. I mean, can you imagine if this was still,
these
two guys were still doing this today? So you've been able to put that in, to see cause and effect.
Right.
And and the relationships, you know, the book is really a wonderful romp. You know, you have a moment with Bob Hope. There's just all these different, well, you got to hang out at the Hilton.
At the Hilton, I think we're going to leave here and go to the Hilton.
When you're in Gainesville.
When you're in Gainesville.
There's no other place to go. I mean,
and having been to Gainesville, you are absolutely right. There's the university if you want to go hang out in a football field, I guess.
Right. So what are you working on next?
Well, I'm going to – I'm you know, that 800-page original autobiography, I'm actually taking – I'm going to make two other books out of it is the plan. I mean, I've kind of already written most of it, but one of them is going to be more of a philosophy book about animal rights and about some of my experiences, like my – so-called terrorist act, rescuing some pigeons from a house and, you know, working for the FBI doing as a lecturer and that kind of thing. And then the other book is going to be the rest of my life, which I've been held at gunpoint a couple of times. I've had some very – I was a maid in a house when I first – because I came to L.A. with $500. So I was starting over when I came. And so I had all sorts of weird jobs. I was a dancer in those little sleazy clubs for a while, you know, like a bikini dancer kind of thing. And so I had a lot of, like, unusual things that I did, and more party crashing stuff, and you know, just kind of, you know, the rest of that story, and also trying to get my husband to marry me, which was it was a full time job for a long time,
5 years,
perseverance,
and some of my bad dates with guys, and some of the other experiences I've had. So it's pretty humorous. I mean, the next book on that is very. It's pretty much just all funny, you know? And so yeah, so that's the kind of the continuation of my stories, and then and I do eventually want to do a story about my grandfather because I found my birth parents and I met my brother and sister a couple of years ago for the first time, and they didn't even know they had a sister, so it was pretty cool. And my grandfather has got an amazing story. He was killed by a devil worshiper in West Virginia in the 1940s. And I mean, I'm Italian, which I did not know when I was a kid, and I'm very proud of being Italian, to say. And but you know, it was almost, you know, almost as bad as being black when you were in West Virginia. I mean, people were prejudiced against Italians, and it was very difficult for my relatives. My grandfather was an attorney, but he was dirt poor from a very poor family, and he was the only one who got to that level. And he was kicked out of law offices. He was kicked out of his house because there was a no Italians allowed in the neighborhood. And then there was this guy that lived down the street who was a devil worshiper who ended up doing a double murder suicide, killing my grandfather, killing his wife, killing himself, setting off two bombs in his house. I mean, it's a huge. This is a small town in West Virginia. This was like the biggest news in a century. I mean, it was amazing. And my grandfather. Father was going to run for U.S. Senate. So it was like amazing story. It's just unbelievable. And I'd like to do a historical fiction with that.
Well, the book is called Rebel in High Heels, written by Charlotte Laws, and it's her story up to and including dates with Tom Jones.
And more.
Chit-chatting.
Oh, my gosh. It's fabulous.
Fabulous book. Just enjoyed the hell out of it. I read it in one day. Charlotte, give us your email addresses and your websites.
Facebook and Twitter and all that.
You can go to rebelinhighheels.com if you want to find out about the book.
Okay.
On Twitter, I'm at Charlotte Laws. My email is drlaws@roadrunner.com. And my main website is charlottelaws.com.
And do you have any book? You know, I know you just had a book signing. Is there any?
I do have one coming up, and it's at Crown Books in the Woodland Hills in the mall, and it's on Sunday, September 20th, I believe it is. And I think it's at 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
We'll make sure to post that too on our Facebook page.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Great.
Yeah.
Great.
Well, we've enjoyed having you. And when you get your next book out, can you come back?
I can.
Oh, score.
This has been really, really wonderful.
It's been a great, great hour.
Thank you so much.
Really,
thank
you.
Really enjoyed having you.
Yeah, really.
Next week, we have John Biggs.
Yes.
From Oklahoma, and he's the one that writes all the spiritual Indian Oklahoma stuff.
Yeah, I just finished Popsicle Sticks, I think, which is a fascinating read. Fascinating read, and I know you're working on one.
Owl Dreams, I think.
So this will be really interesting too.
Yeah, yeah. He's a really nice guy. I try to get a hold of everybody before they come on the show. And so I called you yesterday. Mm-hmm. She's going, what? I like to get a hold of everybody. Sometimes it's not available, especially guys who are on the phone. So with that being said, this is Thursday. We'll see you next Thursday. And as our friend Court Joyner says, take it away, Bobby.
Right on and fight on.
That's it. Right hard and fight hard. Thanks for being with us, folks. Have a great week, and we'll see you next week.